Hello, my name is Katie Tizington Turner, and you are listening to All Access Pass. We are broadcasting from CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver on the unceded ancestral territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. We've got some exciting audio clips that we're going to be playing today, but to start us off, we are going to be introducing all of you to our newest member of the collective. DP will be starting things off in that way, speaking to Nahid. And after that, the rest of the episode features recordings from a UBC Centennial Series speech that happened on March 5th from Canada's new Justice Minister and UBC Law School graduate, Jody Wilson-Raybould, along with live commentary from yours truly, the Accessibility Collective, as we discuss how what she said relates to accessibility and inclusion, which is what we're talking about on this show. So, DP, would you like to start us off?
Sure. We have a new collective member named Nahid, and to get to know her, I will be asking her some questions. Nahid, welcome to All Access Pass.
Thank you.
Tell me a little bit about yourself. Where are you from and what brought you to UBC?
Thanks, DP. Firstly, I'd like to thank the collective for having me. I'm from Tanzania. I'm Indian Tanzanian, was born and raised in Tanzania, and I came to UBC and more specifically Musqueam Territory in 2012 to pursue an undergraduate degree.
What is your major here at UBC?
I'm currently double majoring in psychology and gender, race, sexuality, and social justice, otherwise known as GRSJ.
When are you graduating?
The plan is to graduate within the year, hopefully. We'll see how things go if I can get all my credits done in time.
Why did you want to be involved in the Accessibility Collective and be a part of our weekly show?
So as part of one of my classes for GRSJ, we have a practicum aspect. I was sitting in class and heard Katie talk about her experiences with the Accessibility Collective, and I got really excited by what she had to say and saw the not only the relevance to what I was studying, but also an opportunity to learn about something new that I don't really know much about. And also, I'm just really excited to work with all of you on these topics.
Well, again, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for that. So now we're going to a song break, and the song is called Read All About It by Paper Boy off the album called Strike.
First day on the job, I might just shake myself apart. Oh! And if those pieces meet the streets, yeah, they'll wander down. Open my mouth and the words fall out, calling out at the top of my lungs. Extra, extra, read all about it, read all about it. Extra, read all about it, read all about it, whoa. Black, black, black are these hands of mine, they just won't ever come clean. And oh my God, I swear this city's gonna swallow me alive. Subway cars and traffic lights. Open my mouth and the words fall out, calling out at the top of my lungs. Extra, extra, read all about it, read all about it. Extra, read all about it, read all about it, oh, oh. Woo! Oh.
Welcome back to All Access Pass on CITR 101.9 FM. My name is Molly McAllister. Up next, you'll be listening to parts of a speech given by Canada's new Minister of Justice, the Honourable Jody Wilson-Raybould. The Allard School of Law at UBC hosted the minister for the UBC Centennial Speaker Series at the new Alumni Centre on March 5th. She is a UBC Law School graduate and previously served as a lawyer and Crown Prosecutor in Vancouver, and this year made her way onto the political landscape with a victory in the new riding of Vancouver-Granville, as she was elected as Liberal MP and then selected as part of Justin Trudeau's cabinet as the Justice Minister and Attorney General. Before you hear from her, we're sharing the words of Larry Grant, who welcomed Justice Minister to UBC with a greeting on behalf of the Musqueam people. Here he is.
Good morning, everyone. Good morning. I'm Larry Grant from Musqueam. I just left this my Musqueam name, and I'd like to do a few words and welcome. CM this year, I have a Bonasque, a Tanitra Maskin. Well, since you went in, the Plano, the Voltimoto, the Helix, the Quinoa, even Denton, which we eat to eat, just all from Maskin. Stack when you went in, the Plano, said to something, meet the soul, the theater, the Helix, I said, the same this year. Mae'n aeth yn eich gwalwyn gwn ti gwasnol i chwi i ti i dyn nhw yn aeth yn. Just want to say thank you. Thank you to everyone that's here. Thank you for the coordinators for having me here to do, you know, be a part of the welcoming. I'm Larry Grant. I'm from the Musqueam people who have lived on this land for thousands of years. 4,000 years in our community at Musqueam, and approximately 10,000 years as the Delta being formed. And our ancestor, Capilano, the warrior that had met Captain Narvaez of the Spanish and Captain George Vancouver of the English, lived in the fortified site called Culloden down by the museum, between the Museum of Anthropology and Wreck Beach. Lived there with the warrior families. So that is our great, great, great grandparent that met with the newcomers that first came to this land. So that's a little bit of how long we've been here, where our communities, one of our communities have been. And again, on behalf of the Hunter-Mainan-Peking Musqueam people, I raise my hand and welcome to all of you here, especially to our Minister of Justice that is returning here to campus. So it's really good to see that. I raise my hand and welcome to all of you here this morning. Hi,
All right, now we'll be sharing what Justice Minister Jody Wilson-Raybould had to say to the audience. She starts things off with an introduction to her new role in Canadian government and some important issues currently on the table. She touches on the ways in which political decisions are made in the Indigenous system of consensus and compromise, where every voice is considered. Here is the beginning of her speech.
Good morning. Certainly it's an honor to be here and to be see so many people gathered on Musqueam territory. I would, of course, like to thank Elder Grant for the welcome to Coast Salish territory and specifically Musqueam. I am a little bit... I feel really good today. The sun came out. I think coming to UBC, or maybe it was because the triathlon's happening today. But I wanted to certainly acknowledge Dr. Martha Piper for that incredible welcome and acknowledgement of what a great institution this is, and celebrating the 100 years and welcoming me back here. And to Gordon Christie for that kind introduction. I am, of course, again, pleased to be here, and certainly acknowledge all of the leaders that are in the room. Acknowledge my provincial colleague, the Minister for British Columbia, Susan Anton, and certainly wanted to acknowledge all of the students that are here, and all members that live in and around Vancouver. As was said, UBC is my alma mater. Myself and my sister went to law school. We graduated in 1999. It seems like a long time ago, 16 years ago, I guess, is a bit of a long time ago. And before us, my father graduated from UBC Law School in 1973. And the last time I was at UBC was actually after I graduated. I graduated in what they called the bunker at the time. It was a concrete building where trees grew through the windows and the cement. But I received a tremendous education at the university, and certainly has served me well in the work that I've done. A lot has happened since I was last here during the campaign speaking to law students, and I appreciate the opportunity to come here to speak about what our government is doing and to speak about some of my priorities in my role. Still a very relatively new role as the Minister of Justice and the Attorney General of Canada. Of course, it was a great privilege for me to be elected as the first member of Parliament in the great new riding of Vancouver Granville, and I was equally honored to have been asked by Prime Minister Trudeau to be the Minister of Justice and the Attorney General. An appointment that I think speaks volumes about how far we've come as a country, as well as the important work that lies ahead. As I've said elsewhere, this appointment is certainly, for me, a personal accomplishment, but I view it not so much a reflection on myself personally, but rather the symbolism of what the appointment itself represents. That in a nation where an Indigenous person who not so long ago could not vote, let alone run for office, or practice as a lawyer, a person against whom the law discriminated, and to a certain degree still does, who fought for years against that law, is now the principal lawyer in charge of administering that law and advising its government on behalf of that very nation. Sinking in. So it's on this thought that I wanted to acknowledge this beautiful hall that we're in, Jack Poole Hall. I think that Mr. Poole, and I know there's people in this room that know him better than I did, would have been delighted that I am speaking here today in my new capacity. He was a man who clearly understood the need for reconciliation with Indigenous peoples, and whose efforts with the four host First Nations during the 2010 Olympics was exemplary. As Minister of Justice and Attorney General, I am the steward of the Canadian legal system. And while I can think of no greater honor, I am also equally struck by the gravity of the responsibility and accountability entrusted to me, but also the great opportunity. Opportunities that can only be realized through and with focus, hard work, and cooperation with others, many others. For those of you who know me, you know that I've been an advocate for change most of my life. My upbringing, education, professional and personal experiences have all helped shape my worldview and the way that I work, as well as the perspective and the way that I approach my role as minister. In the Indigenous political system in which I was raised, it is in the big house where our laws are made and important decisions taken. In this system, there are no political parties. Rather, there is a belief in consensus. The issues are debated, and while everyone may not agree on every aspect of the decision to be taken, consensus, and if necessary, compromise, is sought in order to achieve balance in society. It helps to ensure that decisions are durable, legitimate, and survive the test of time. Maybe this is because we lived in small villages and people simply did not leave, but I like to think it is because we value everyone's opinion and every voice counts, not just the few. This system, truth be told, contrasts sharply from the partisan nature of the environment in which I am now a part. For me, I do not think I will ever get used to the type of politics or etiquette in the House of Commons, particularly during the question period. It is here where hyperpartisan politics seems to be the order of the day and certainly works against the idea of achieving consensus. That said, I truly believe that most parliamentarians want to work together. When we work together in common purpose and vision, we can achieve amazing things. Canadians definitely want politicians of all stripes to work together with less partisanship, not just in Parliament, but between and among different levels of government. This is something that was made very clear to me during the 11-week election campaign, and this is why the First Minister's meeting here in Vancouver this week, I believe, was so significant. Not just because the First Minister has reached consensus on moving forward on studying carbon pricing mechanisms, but rather because of the fact that they met at all. The first time a Prime Minister has met with First Ministers in over 7 years. The clear message being that we cannot build Canada unless we work together. A message that is broadened when we hear and consider multiple voices. This lies at the core of our Prime Minister's vision and what our government wants to accomplish, as well as my own personal vision. Namely, as Canadians, we must continue to embrace and build on the incredible diversity that is Canada, and in doing so, make us stronger economically, but more importantly, socially, a beacon of hope in an otherwise divided and troubled world. And I know we can do even better as a country. And how can we do better? Since forming government, our team, itself diverse, has begun to re-examine what we do, why we do it, and how we measure success. We are identifying what is working, what is not working, and how we can change for the better. Not simply change for change's sake. For a start, we are broadening the concept of success beyond economic wealth to include physical and social well-being, equality, and fairness. And in measuring this, we are looking to ensure that all Canadians share in this success. This is very important. If a strong economy disproportionately benefits the few, you cannot say this is a just society. Moreover, you also sow the seeds of discontent. A strong economy must always be seen as a means to an end and not the end in itself. The end being a higher quality of life for all. In terms of specific priorities and meeting a vision for a more inclusive Canada, my priorities and those of our government have been shared publicly through the posting of ministers' mandate letters from the Prime Minister. The first in Canada's history that federal ministers' mandate letters have been made public. This is an act that reflects our government's general approach to relationships with Canadians, as with other levels of government and within government, that of being more open and transparent. To aid in these efforts, my office is also looking to be more open and transparent, as well as effective and efficient. To me, these concepts are inseparable. In fact, it is very clear to me that Canadians want to be more engaged in how their nation is governed and discuss substantive policy issues with decision makers on the very matters of concern that and issues that affect them. I believe that working with Canadians to better inform cabinet and to better inform parliament enriches us all and better policy is achieved. So all across government, both externally and internally, we have started to consult and to listen more. And people should not confuse the time needed for consultation and reflection with inaction or indecisiveness. Quite the contrary. This is what governing in the modern era demands. People can participate in many different ways. Also, with access to more information, they can see how decisions are arrived at and judge for themselves whether the decisions that are being made reflect one's values. They can also consider what they would have done in the same situation and with the same information. So in my mandate letter, I am tasked to ensure that all decisions made by our government and proposed legislation are compliant with and guided by the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, our commitments, and our values as Canadians. In Canada, as we know, the primary legal expression of our respect for diversity is through the Charter, where, regardless of faith, gender, sexual orientation, or race, all people are able to see themselves reflected in their constitution, knowing that if you work hard and abide by the rule of law, you will have every opportunity to succeed, confident in the knowledge that your institutions of good governance will protect and support you. In many ways, I see my role as being the ambassador of the Charter. In my mandate letter, or it also directs me to review Canada's litigation strategy. And as part of this review, I've already either discontinued appeals or am reconsidering the Crown's position in others. We have taken action on several cases, including our government's duty to provide health care to refugees, the right to wear the niqab in citizenship ceremonies, collective bargaining with public sector unions, abandoning the appeal of the decision to grant Gomer Cotter's bail, and the decision not to appeal the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal decision respecting discrimination in Indigenous child welfare.
That was the Justice Minister's first part of her speech. Tying in that clip to our topic of accessibility, we can look to the law regarding niqabs at citizenship ceremonies. Canada prides itself on being a multicultural society, but to deny people their rights to wear niqabs at citizenship ceremonies creates inequity among new Canadians and denies access to the rights and freedoms of individuals with various cultural practices and identities. The new government has recognized this inequity and has changed protocol going forward. Policy changes such as these are promising and strive for a more inclusive Canada, which the Justice Minister highlights. Also, the provision of health care for refugees also relates to accessibility, as many require physical and mental health services as they arrive in Canada.
All right, time for another song. Here is Victoria's Own Northcote with Hope Is Made of Steel.
You left your home where you were born, and you followed your fury, you followed your soul in the backyard swinging. Backstreet's killing time. You said anything can be realized. Yeah, but I'm never satisfied. Whoa, hope is made of steel, but our heart is made of dust. Won't you tell me that you're real? My hope is made of steel.
passionate, playful, and provocative storytelling. Theater at UBC's upcoming show, The Arabian Nights, by acclaimed playwright Mary Zimmerman, is being directed by Evan Frayne and running from March 17th to April the 2nd at the Frederick Wood Theater. The narrative centers around Scheherazade's tales told to King Shahryar in hopes that she may live another night. Or 1001 nights.
Three women, dressed in lingerie, were hanging from the ceiling on meat hooks. In an adjacent room, a man was in bed with two deceased females, also wearing lingerie. He positioned their arms in a sexy embrace. Down the hall, a man holding a chainsaw stood over the motionless body of a sixth woman, lying on a table covered in plastic. These are scenes from a popular music video by a Grammy Award-winning artist. If we want violence against women to stop, shouldn't we stop treating it like entertainment? Join the conversation at #NotOkay.
Welcome back to All Access Pass on CITR 101.9. I am Spencer. In this next clip, the Justice Minister speaks about her mandate letter from the Prime Minister, and emerging issues are in the national political landscape. You will hear her address the legalization of marijuana and the steps the government is taking to change accessibility and equality. Where am I? Marijuana is used by many people to train to treat chronic illness or symptoms accompanied by physical disabilities, and laws regarding medical assistance in dying. Just bear with me here. Dying address. Fair and legal access to safe medical care and rights for Canadians to make free choices concerning their own dignity, suffering, and death. Doctor-assisted suicide is a topic many people still disagree on, and laws and policies have to be changed with extreme caution and consideration. Oh, God. Here's the clip.
mandated to undertake a comprehensive review of the criminal justice system, including sentencing reform over the past 10 years. No small task. Our society has clearly evolved in recent decades. The issues facing Canada now differ greatly from the issues we faced 5 or 10 years ago. As a result, we need to find new and better approaches to address these emerging issues effectively. So I'll now turn to two issues that are dominating headlines: the legalization of marijuana and medical assistance in dying. As you're probably aware, our government has committed to legalize, regulate, and restrict access to marijuana in a careful and orderly way. And in accordance with our approach to inclusivity, we will take the time necessary to get this right. In the coming months, our government will be establishing a provincial federal task force that will hear from experts and recommend a Made in Canada approach. I will be working with my parliamentary secretary, Mr. Bill Blair, supported by the Ministers of Health and Public Safety, to design a system of strict regulation with strong sanctions that keep marijuana out of the hands of children and the profits out of the hands of criminals. Next, medical assistance in dying, another highly complex social and legal issue, one that we must address in a timely manner due to the imposed timeframes of the court. Much has changed since Sue Rodriguez's case in the mid-1990s. The Supreme Court of Canada has spoken in Kay Carter and Gloria Taylor case. And while there will never be full agreement on these issues or the issues involved, we must strive to achieve consensus on the response that we will present to Parliament in the coming months. While we did get a 4-month extension from the court-imposed deadline, we must and are working diligently to have a solution in place by June 6th. Despite the time crunch, we have made good progress. Last year, both federal and provincial external panels of experts gathered evidence and listened to the views of a broad range of Canadians and international experts. And late last month, a special joint committee on physician-assisted dying released its recommendations. This was a parliamentary committee made up of members of parliament and senators that heard over 60 stakeholders, witnesses, and received submissions from thousands of Canadians across the country. Now, the Minister of Health and I are working with our caucus, our officials, and our parliamentary colleagues to design an effective solution. There are so many questions that need to be answered. What type of regime would best serve Canadians? How do we protect the autonomy of Canadians to make decisions about their bodies while also safeguarding the most vulnerable among us? How can we ensure access from coast to coast to coast while also protecting the conscience rights of medical practitioners? What kind of partnership can be forged with the provinces and territories as well as with other stakeholders? Clearly, the best way to answer these questions is through careful and open collaboration among people with different views, by looking at those best placed to help us work through these issues, by making relevant information readily available to Canadians and reporting on progress. We can create the environment that will position us to best achieve the best possible solution for Canada on this incredibly sensitive issue. So moving to another issue briefly, one which I am asked about quite regularly, how are we going to find the right balance between security and personal freedoms? This, of course, was a hot issue during the last election, continues to be as we consider then Bill C-51, the Anti-Terrorism Act. This is very much on our government's radar. Currently, I'm working with the Minister of Public Safety and Emergency Preparedness, Ralph Goodell, to review the problematic parts of Bill C-51, while providing the proper oversight and accountability. We will hold meaningful consultations on our national security framework, where the objective is to ensure the safety of Canadians while protecting our rights and freedoms, to find the right balance.
Hi, this is Katie again. I hope you're enjoying listening to the clips of the Minister of Justice speaking so far on All Access Pass today. We were there on March 5th, and we listened, we being Molly and I, listened to the whole speech, and the minister's speech ended with a focus on Canada's criminal justice system and the problems that it's currently facing. The system is currently plagued by inequity for minority populations and people with mental illness or substance addiction, and the inaccessibility of successful reintegration into society and exit from the system. Population representation, especially of women and Indigenous peoples, is dramatically skewed among those who are incarcerated in Canada, and the minister poses progressive solutions, including mechanisms to address root causes of criminal behavior, restorative justice practices, and specialized courts to support unique needs of individuals. The inaccessibility of re-entry into a more normal life creates a cycle of incarceration, and that can be difficult to break. And this feeds back into the communities of those who are disproportionately exposed to the criminal justice system already. What can be worse is that the periods of incarceration in this cycle may be characterized by small crimes that do not warrant the amount of time spent engaging with the system in the first place, or that the release system does not integrate adequate support for individuals with mental health or substance abuse challenges. This also perpetuates a cycle that may otherwise be avoidable. So here is a clip covering some of those issues by the Justice Minister now.
Finally, and relatedly, I want to turn to criminal justice reforms that we're trying to achieve. As mentioned earlier, we will be part, or these will be part of an overall re-examination of the criminal justice system, which must be based on evidence and on principle. In this context, there are three areas that we will examine. The first is that our current criminal justice system disproportionately affects the most vulnerable segments of our population. For example, and as we probably have all read in the claims, we know that Indigenous peoples interact with the criminal justice system in shockingly high numbers. Indigenous peoples are far more likely than other Canadians to be arrested, prosecuted, and incarcerated. Last year, Indigenous peoples comprised more than 20% of the federal inmate population, despite the fact of only making up 4% of Canada's population. And the numbers keep getting worse. The number of Indigenous peoples behind bars has increased by 17% in the last 5 years, up 112% for women. According to the last figures available, more than 36% of adult women sentenced to custody in this country were Indigenous. Clearly, the number is 9 times too high. As a former Crown prosecutor, the story is unfortunately all too familiar. A young person, all too often an Indigenous male, commits a nonviolent property crime, comes into contact with the justice system, and never leaves. He's caught in a vicious cycle of court appearances, court orders, breaches of court orders, and returns to custody. So the young person is spending more time behind bars than in their community and has little hope of breaking the cycle. To be clear, the examination of the criminal justice system will not focus solely on how we treat Indigenous peoples. The truth is that many offenders have some combination of mental illness and addiction. Up to 80% of all federal offenders have past or present substance abuse issues. Some studies indicate that 2/3 of all crimes are committed while under the influence of alcohol or drugs. So let us imagine a Canada in which the justice system better aligns with the needs of all Canadians. What if an offender's first interaction with the criminal justice system did not become the first in a series? What if it triggered mechanisms designed to address the factors that inspired the criminal behavior in the first place? What if we intentionally and deliberately built off-ramps to the system so that the individual's first interaction with the justice system gave them avenues to pursue and to ensure that it was also their last? Clearly, we need innovative solutions. And, Minister, there are innovative solutions. One of these is to consider greater use of restorative justice measures and other alternative measures to incarceration, where appropriate, such as sentencing circles. These measures seek to make both the victim and the offender active participants in the journey for justice. It emphasizes repairing the relationship between the victim and the offender. Victims have a powerful voice, and this process allows them to heal, while at the same time focuses on the offender taking important accountability for their actions. These measures are proven effective. In 2011, the Department of Justice report found that Indigenous people who completed a community-based alternative to mainstream justice were significantly less likely to reoffend than those that did not take the program. Another innovative way to break the cycle may be through specialized courts, including First Nations courts, community courts, and drug treatment courts. Community courts use case management to help offenders make long-term behavioral changes. Here in Vancouver, the downtown community court hears a wide variety of cases, except for those most serious, and tailors the sentence to the offender and the offense. Courts like drug treatment courts, also here in Vancouver, integrate justice, health, and social service agencies in an attempt to modify the offender's behavior. A study of this court showed that the risk of reoffending among participants was reduced by more than 50%. Restorative justice measures, like restorative justice programs and specialized courts, are more collaborative and inclusive, more culturally relevant, and more likely to meet the needs of the communities they serve. Moreover, because they look at solving the problem that caused the behavior in the first place, rather than just punishment, they can give offenders a way out of the system, where appropriate. Second area to closely examine is what we define as a criminal offense. While remaining vigilant about those truly serious offenses, to ensure that resources are dedicated to the right things. Our system continues to be bogged down by cases involving relatively minor, nonviolent conduct and administration of justice offenses, often committed by a group of prolific offenders whose criminal conduct is driven by particular factors such as addictions or health and social problems. How the criminal justice system responds to this conduct requires careful consideration. This work could include looking at how we treat criminals, or, for example, how we respond from a sentencing perspective. It also should look at the important role discretion plays in the criminal justice system. Currently, the justice system devotes most of its resources to administration of justice offenses, such as the failure to appear in court or breach of parole. In 2009, these cases accounted for 21% of all cases and cost taxpayers an estimated $729 million. And most involved chronic offenders caught up in this vicious cycle I spoke about earlier. Clearly, this is not a good situation. Only through careful examination of what we classify as a criminal offense can we recalibrate our efforts and resources of the justice system to address serious crimes. This could have the biggest impact and produce the greatest results for Canadians in reforming our justice system. And the third and final area to reflect on is the rate at which the world is changing. The criminal justice system must keep pace with this change in order to meet the needs of our society. For example, technology has created new opportunities for criminals. Statistics suggest that cybercrime is increasing in Canada. Between 2011 and 2013, the RCMP saw the reported incidences of cybercrime increase by more than 40%. And incredibly, 1.75 million Canadians reported that they had been cyberbullied, but only 7% of victims reported the incident to police. Issues like cybercrime, cyber fraud, online crimes against children and minors, and the protection of online privacy have never been more prevalent. Our justice system must address these new issues and be able to react quickly while remaining true to Canadian values. And so finally, before I close, let me say this. Our constantly evolving society is underpinned by our justice system. The common and civil law must continue to reflect our values, and they must keep pace with our society as it advances. So too must the laws enacted by Parliament and other lawmaking bodies. We must have a living system of multi-level governance and cooperative federalism alongside an independent judiciary. And Canada's continued success absolutely depends on including multiple voices in the conversations we have about the type of country we want, increasingly involving those who may not have been part of the conversation before. I am convinced that more involvement will lead to richer outcomes, informed outcomes, informed by the diversity of perspectives. This is how we must forge solutions and build a stronger Canada. As I said, I'm truly honored to be the Minister of Justice and the Attorney General of Canada at this incredibly important period in our history. And I look forward to giving back to our country through public service. In terms of public service, and I'm looking at Mr. Bazran, our Regional Director General for British Columbia, I am grateful to the thousands of public servants in my department. Their work not only supports me in my role, but it also, more importantly, protects the integrity of the justice system, in which protects our way of life. I have great aspirations for this country. I know that this country has not yet met its full potential and is still a work in progress. And while I'm seized with the urgency to act quickly and deliver meaningful results for Canadians today, we must ensure that we get it right. Working together, we can and will make a difference. Gaila Kusla, thank you for having me here today.
Welcome back to All Access Pass on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. I'm Molly McAllister. Thanks for joining us tonight and listening to that speech by the Honourable Jody Wilson-Raybould, Canada's newest Minister of Justice and Attorney General. We think that it's really cool that she talked so much about diversifying the voices that are contributing to Canadian politics and having all Canadians' voices heard. Because on our show, that's kind of what we're all about as well. As the Accessibility Collective, we're a group of students and community members of all backgrounds, abilities, and experience levels. And our mandate on our show is not just to address issues of accessibility, but to make radio accessible for all voices too. This week's been a really neat episode because I think you've heard just about everyone's voice on the radio on our collective tonight. And it's really neat to see everyone contribute in their own way. We're just about out of time for tonight's episode. We hoped you enjoyed hearing about what the future of justice looks like in Canadian politics, and that you can spend the rest of your evening just being grateful that we don't have to worry about what Canadian justice would look like in the hands of a man by the name of Donald Trump. That's a reason to spend your weekend celebrating in Vancouver in the sunshine. Thanks for joining us tonight, and make sure to tune your dials back to CITR 101.9 FM for another episode of All Access Pass next Thursday at 5 p.m. Up next on air is UBC Arts on Air, and we're going to end things off with a song.
So my name is DP, and I'm going to leave you the last song, which is called Not Up to Me by Candy from the album In Flames.